This week, we air a pre-recorded interview with Zane Lackey, Chief Security Officer at Signal Sciences, and we talk about advising. In the Leadership and Communication segment, customer surveys are no substitute for actually talking to customers. CEOs most concerned about cybersecurity in 2019, the open workspace doesn't work, and more. Business Security Weekly starts now.
This is Security Weekly. For security professionals, by security professionals. Broadcasting live from G-Unit Studios in Rhode Island, it's the show where we explore the business of security to improve the security of business. Your trusted source for actionable insights on leadership, communication, and innovation. Get ready for Business Security Weekly. Do you have a website, an external presence, employees, an office? Any of these things can be compromised and attacked. How are you defending your assets? Have you penetration tested your public assets? Start 2018 by taking a proactive approach to securing your vulnerable areas. Black Hills Information Security has been helping companies find their weaknesses since 2008. Email consulting at blackhillsinfosec.com and see how they can help you sleep better at night. How much confidence do you have in your security program? TrustedSec is a global information security consulting firm created by Dave Kennedy with some of the industry's most respected professionals. Their team works collaboratively with your company to improve security, regardless of its current maturity level. TrustedSec offers an ever-growing list of customized services, including red and purple teaming, software and hardware security, incident response, PCI, and risk and maturity assessments. You can visit trustedsec.com/securityweekly to learn how TrustedSec can become an extension of your team.
Welcome to Business Security Weekly. This is episode number 114, recorded January 21st, 2019. It is Martin Luther King Day. I am your host, Matt Alderman, here in Colorado, getting ready for another snowstorm tonight. And today I am solo. Paul is home with the kids and probably celebrating a victory yesterday after one heck of a game with the Patriots and the Chiefs. RSA Conference 2019 is the place to be for the latest in cybersecurity data, innovation, and thought leadership. From March 4th to 8th, San Francisco will come alive with cybersecurity's brightest minds as they gather together to discuss the industry's newest developments. Go to rsaconference.com/securityweekly-US19 to register now using the discount code 5U9SWFD to receive $100 off your full conference pass. Security Weekly will be in Broadcast Alley on Monday and Tuesday of RSA Conference this year, recording both sponsored interviews and hosting briefings. We'll be sharing more details soon. Also, check out our on-demand material. Some of our previously recorded webcasts are now available on demand at securityweekly.com/on-demand. All right, so I get to debate the articles all by myself this week. And so I pulled some interesting ones that I could use to kind of debate myself, I guess, a little bit. And the first article I pulled was, make sure morale doesn't suffer when a favorite team member leaves. And look, we've all been in this situation. When you work in startups and you work in large organizations, you're going to have turnover, right? You're going to have team members that you like, that you've worked with, they leave. And I've seen a lot of this in my career. We were just actually having a conversation with this with one of my advisory clients earlier this morning on how do you help the team keep their morale up when this happens in an environment. And this article points out a couple really good things that I thought was interesting. One, you know, show appreciation for the one that's leaving, no matter the circumstance. You know, sometimes they're leaving because they want to. Sometimes it's the best for the organization for that person to leave. But show appreciation for that person that's leaving. It's a respectful way for that person to leave. It creates a good environment for the team itself, which I thought, you know, is something that's really important here. The other tip that came out of this was, you know, answer questions with transparency and respect. Why are they leaving? Just be open and honest about it. I'm a big believer in trust and being open and honest. I think it's good when employees leave to answer questions and make sure people understand why they're leaving and treat that person with respect as they leave. And then, you know, this last tip, which is kind of obvious, you know, invest in the health of your team, right? Identify, you know, areas as part of this dialogue of, you know, how they feel about it. You know, what can we do to improve the work environment if that's why they're leaving or whatever it is. But again, when a person leaves, you got to typically go replace that person. That's hard to go out and recruit, hire good talent, train them, bring them up to speed. And so, you know, you want to build that health across the entire team because you don't have to do this often. I think it gets really hard for organizations as they continually have to try to replace some of those key, that key personnel in the environment. So some very interesting tips here when an employee leaves. All right, my second article is how to debate ideas productively at work. And I pulled this one out because I'm not very good at this sometimes. My career has been interesting when it comes to debating ideas and in different aspects, right? We all have kind of our beliefs in what a company should do. Sometimes the company doesn't, sometimes they don't. And that's typically why I leave organizations or have left in the past is, you know, you kind of get to a point where you don't think you can move things forward anymore. So how do you share ideas productively and don't end up in some of those situations? So I thought this was a good refresher for me, but might help some other leaders out there as they think about how do we move ideas forward in an organization. And the first one is, look, we're all on the same team. That's obvious. But I think what's important is we have to treat each other with respect on that team. And as we look at introducing new ideas and concepts and directions for the company to take, it should be for the benefit of the entire organization, for the whole team, and not just a personal reason. And so obviously that kind of makes sense across the board. But it's the second one that I think is probably the one that's really, really important. And that is keep it about facts, logic, and the topic at hand. Sometimes we get a little personal. I always like to back up directions with facts. If there's an idea that we should do something new or expand into a different area, you want to bring facts and logic to the table to present that idea. It shouldn't be a gut instinct. It should be really factually based. And if we do that, then we can support those ideas and hopefully move them forward. Now, there are times when organizations, even with the facts, decide not to move forward with a specific idea. As executives and leaders in the company, we just have to acknowledge that and move on. And sometimes that's hard, sometimes that's easy, but that's where I've typically seen friction when you try to bring some of these ideas to light. And then the last one is, you know, don't make it personal. I'm not very good at this sometimes. Sometimes it gets a little personal and we should watch that. But, you know, it's a good idea. Try to keep it all about the business. Don't try to make this about an individual, whether it's you or about somebody else, when you're pitching these ideas and concepts. It's just a really good idea to try to keep it at the business level. In our industry, specifically in security, you know, we don't want to burn bridges. Our industry is small, right? And if we can, you know, keep it at a business level and understand from a business perspective we don't agree, that's fine. But try not to make this personal. So just some good tips on how to productively share ideas within an organization. Let's see, my next leadership article. I love this one. Customer surveys are no substitute for actually talking to customers. I'm a big believer in this one. We tend to want to use surveys because it's easy. We can craft a single survey, send it out to a number of customers, collect the results, and then try to understand some trends out of it. That's a good way to collect some broad-based data, but it's not a substitute for actually sitting down and talking to the customer. And there's a number of examples in this article, but I can also bring some articles, some experience myself. One of the things that I did when I was at Tenable, I visited a lot of customers throughout the world. It wasn't just North America. I mean, I traveled over to Asia 3 to 4 times a year. I traveled into Europe and the Middle East at least a handful times a year. really to sit down with customers and understand what are they looking for. And when you sit down with a customer and you ask them open-ended questions, you tend to get a lot more detail and a lot more information than a survey can ever provide you. And so I think it's invaluable to be able to go out, sit down with customers and have a dialogue, really understand what problems are they facing? What are some of the areas that they can or can't find solutions for? Just simple things, but it comes across so much easier when you're sitting down and talking to them face to face instead of just trying to read some results out of a pre-canned survey. Because in a pre-canned survey, it's really hard to ask the open-ended questions that allow a lot more data to come to you if you just listen to the response and let them talk. I think it's a great way to do it. So if you're looking for feedback from your customers, go out and talk to them. It's the best way to get some of that valuable feedback. All right, let's see, what else do I have up here today? This one is interesting a little bit, and I brought this article up only because my former boss is going. So Davos, world leaders need to grasp future technological risks. So I saw an article last week that Renaud Derson, co-founder at Tenable, my former boss over at Tenable, is actually going over to Davos as part of this dialogue. I think it's great that cybersecurity leaders are going over to talk to other world leaders about technology and technology risk and the challenges with cybersecurity. We need to be able to communicate not only with world leaders, but even just our business leaders to really understand the risks of what the technology revolution is doing. What are the risks associated with cybersecurity as we go through digital transformation? This is an event that, great, we'll get some world leaders there, but I think this is important in general, is that we've got to continue to have dialogue with our business leaders and our governmental leaders to really understand where some of these risks are in the future. So, Renaud, good luck. I hope you have a great dialogue over at Davos. All right, next one. CEOs most concerned about cybersecurity in 2019. I think we know this instinctually in our industry, is that cybersecurity is a concern. What's interesting is cybersecurity this year ranks the highest of all the CEOs' concern. And I think this is the first time it's actually happened. It was a survey of more than 800 international CEOs and 600 C-suite members, where cybersecurity was ranked number one for the top external threat concern for the CEOs, which... wow, you know, we're finally there. We're finally at that level where, you know, people realize cybersecurity is a threat. The U.S. government found that cybersecurity costs the economy $109 billion in 2016. We know that number's higher now. That's the last time we saw this data. And what I thought was really interesting is we beat out, because creating new business is the second largest concern for global CEOs. So if you think about that for a second, cybersecurity is a top risk. Growing the business is the second risk. That's the second top concern. Typically, that's been reversed, right? It's always been about creating new business. But I think what CEOs are starting to realize is that in order to create new business, they have to continue to evolve through this digital transformation that we've been talking about for years. That digital transformation now opens us up to cybersecurity concerns, and now we're actually ahead of revenue generation, which, like I said, that's the first time I've seen this in my career where security ranks above the business. So maybe some good news for us in the cybersecurity space and for budgets this year, but definitely we're on the list for CEOs. Let's see, what did I pull next? Oh, I love this article. The open workspace doesn't work. We know, you know, if you ever walk into a new startup, you'll notice that the layout of a startup is very different than a traditional enterprise organization, right? So if you go to a typical enterprise, you'll see cubicles everywhere. You'll see some offices on along the walls, but you'll see cubicles everywhere. But at a startup now, the trend is, no, it's all about the open workspace. And you walk in and it's literally just tables and monitors. There's no divides. There's no partitions. It doesn't exist. That's the new rave. And a lot of people think that that open workspace promoted better collaboration and happiness. It was more cost effective, which it probably is, and it prevented or alleviated pain because it allowed you to move and stand and have more motion. This article goes in and talks about two of these three aren't true. The first one is about collaboration. It doesn't necessarily promote better collaboration. One of the challenges with an open workspace, according to one of these surveys in this report, is that individuals don't want to constantly interact with their peers. They sometimes want to not interact. And so sometimes the effect of an open workspace is people are more kind of inside themselves. They just don't collaborate. They don't want to talk to people. They kind of want to zone themselves out because it's constant. They kind of go back and are a little more introverted in that way. I thought that was interesting because one of the benefits of supposedly this open workspace is that, you know, you can constantly collaborate. The second one is around preventing pain or alleviating pain, because now you can have, you know, your treadmill at your desk and so you can walk while you work and all these other things. But surveys have also shown that's not actually true either, that they are still seeing a lot of potential pain and other health ailments, even in this environment. So this article just kind of says, look, the open workspace doesn't necessarily work. And so I think it's up to each organization to decide whether this is a culture they want to create or not create. I personally don't like them because I'm on the phone a lot and having open conversations on the phone just doesn't work. So I'm not a big fan of these open workspaces, but I know a lot of startups use them to try to create that culture that they're looking for in the startup environment. So food for thought. All right, now we're going to get into a few other articles. I always like to try to throw in some job talent stuff. I'll throw in a little technology at the end. But Gartner came out with a report, Talent Shortage, a Key Concern for Organizations. I think we've covered this a few times. Yes, we have some talent shortage, not only in cybersecurity, which is one of the top ones. Cloud computing, we've talked about a number of times. Artificial intelligence skill sets. There is a shortage of skilled resources traditionally in our market. Cybersecurity has had a shortage for years, and now we're seeing that move over into some of these new upcoming technologies as well. I think this is great for people who are looking for a career change. You know, if they're looking to specialize, there are some very interesting areas of specialization out there that would allow people to shift, I think, pretty easily in their careers if that's what they wanted to do. Survey of 137 senior executives by Gartner, accelerating privacy regulations, so still a lot of demand for regulatory compliance type resources, cloud computing, which we've talked about. Further down in here, it talks about artificial intelligence and some of the other shortages that we're seeing in the industry. So that's healthy for us as job seekers and for anybody who's looking to get into the space. All right, and my last article here is on technology. And this one I pulled over, this one talks about open source to open newer avenues for CIOs in 2019. And there's a couple pieces in here I want to touch on. There's a couple things I agree with in this article. In general, I do as a whole, but there's a couple areas I kind of wanted to point out. And so the first topic in this article talks about digital business to accelerate interest in artificial intelligence. Okay. Yeah, I get it. But what does that have to do with open source? And they don't get into the open source aspects of artificial intelligence the way I thought they would in this particular article, because I'd like to see what types of open source projects are out there and direct people to some of those a little easier for people who are looking at artificial intelligence projects. but it wasn't in this article. There were some really good ones, though, around open source for open data for business intelligence. There are some projects, community data license agreements, that was announced by the Linux Foundation that are working on some open source projects for open data to help improve business intelligence types work. I thought that was a really interesting place for people to look as they're looking to enhance some of their data analytics and intelligence work on the data side. They do talk about IoT and edge computing in here and how it will turn towards a real-time operating system. They talk here about OpenStack. I actually think the container market is where we'll see a lot more activities, at least with edge computing. IoT, we all know, will be some sort of lightweight firmware-based operating system. Some standardization around that, I think, is important. But when I see new edge computing environments, I'm seeing them move to more containerized, serverless types of architectures, not necessarily an OpenStack deployment, for example. And so I actually think we'll see a lot more serverless container infrastructure in these new edge environments, especially when we're looking at things like industrial IoT plants, planes, all these kind of new edge environments. I think that's what you'll see more than maybe OpenStack is a full-blown solution. It does talk a little bit about software approach to enterprise storage. I think we're going to continue to see new enhancements in the storage side. We're going to continue to add data. How do we make that easier across the board? And the last one, which is near and dear to my heart, is prepping security with DevSecOps. I've talked on this topic for probably a good year and a half of how to integrate security into DevOps and how can we do it without creating a lot of friction for the developers or the operations staff. It's a lot harder than just saying we need to prep security for DevSecOps. We actually need security and the DevOps teams talking more frequently. We need to figure out how to integrate new security tool sets into existing DevOps tool sets and processes if we really want to realize the DevSecOps movement. A lot of people talk about it, but I don't think many people truly understand what needs to happen to integrate security in. Number one, for all you security folks out there listening, developers will not log into your security tool. You have to take that security data, integrate it back into their tools, whether it's Jira or HipChat or Slack. Those are the tools developers use on a day-to-day basis. And if you want them to see your data, you need to really figure out how to integrate your results back into some of those tools they're using. We want to figure out how to integrate with their build systems. We want to figure out how we integrate with other aspects of that CI/CD pipeline. And if we figure that out, we can actually realize the DevSecOps vision, but it's going to take some time. And it's going to take a lot of dialogue. And even though I love it in this article, I just don't think they fully understand what it's going to take to make this happen. So those are my articles for the week. We'll take a short break, and then we will air our pre-recorded interview with Zane Lackey.
The modern attack surface is vast and permeable, extending from the data center to the cloud and device edge. Security teams are stretched thinner and thinner as they try to cover this ground. The result? More high-profile breaches hit the news every day. Don't let your organization be next. ExtraHop delivers security from the inside out, helping enterprise security teams detect threats up to 95% faster and cut staff time to resolve by two-thirds or more. Act with confidence. Learn more at extrahop.com/securityweekly. Effectively securing your organization and its reputation requires a smarter approach. To maximize efficiency and minimize risk, security experts turn to LogRhythm, the only leading solution built solely for security teams by a security team committed to your success. With next-gen SIEM, user and entity behavior analytics, network traffic and behavior analysis, security automation and orchestration, and compliance, LogRhythm provides security made smarter.
Welcome back to Business Security Weekly. I am your host, Matt Alderman, joined by Paul Assadorian. If you are interested in quality over quantity and having meaningful conversations instead of just a badge scan, join us April 1st to 3rd at Disney's Contemporary Resort for InfoSec World 2019, where you can connect and network with like-minded individuals in search of actionable information. Visit infosec.world.misty.com/securityweekly, security-weekly, and use the registration code OS19-SecWeek for 15% off your main conference or world pass. We have a number of interviews scheduled with confirmed speakers across all of our shows, so please tune in to learn more about topics that will be covered at the conference. All right, let's get to our interview segment. Zane Lackey is co-founder and chief security officer at Signal Sciences and the author of Building a Modern Security Program. He serves on multiple public and private advisory boards and is an investor in emerging cybersecurity companies. Prior to co-founding Signal Sciences, Zane led a security team at the forefront of the DevOps Cloud Shift movement as CISO at Etsy. Zane, welcome to Business Security Weekly.
Hey, thanks for having me. It's fun to be on here.
Yeah, well, we wanted to do this segment really on advisory services and advising. You know, I wanted to start a little bit with, you know, you're an advisor and an investor. Sometimes I think investors are also advisors, but how would you see the split in kind of the roles you play today between an investor and just an advisor?
Yeah, I think exactly like you said, the line is pretty blurry. I've seen all of the above, and you know, also I'm kind of doing all of that in my, I'll air quote, spare time, where, you know, when I'm not really focused on Signal Sciences, which takes up almost all of my time. You know, I've seen with some companies that I advise, I've seen some of the investors that they've raised money from just be the kind of type that tend to write a check and then be extremely hands-off. And sometimes that's intentional and sometimes that's just kind of unintentional. Whereas I tend to see, you know, I've seen the same thing from advisors too. But when I try to get involved with a company, whether that's from an advising side or from an investing side, it's because I'm really passionate about helping out other founders. And so whatever mechanism that takes, whether that's via advising, whether that's via investing, or just informally chatting with other founders, I know how challenging it is, and I like to help other founders as much as possible.
Yeah, Zane, and as I look more into this aspect of, you know, helping the security community and security companies, what typically, like when someone is an advisor, is there like some kind of compensation? Like how does that work?
Yeah, it can completely vary. You know, sometimes, and the term advisor ends up being kind of overloaded, mm-hmm. right? Because sometimes there's kind of a customer advisory board where it's your customers giving you feedback about the product or about your roadmap or things like that. Then there's kind of a formal advisor role, which is typically done with like a small bit of equity, mm-hmm. Just to kind of incentivize folks and everything there. Other times I've seen advisory roles where it's paid, mm-hmm. And I've seen advisory roles where it's, even though it's not a customer advisory role, where it's a kind of traditional advisory role where it's completely non-compensated. It really depends. I've kind of seen all of the above, and I think you tend to find like what works for your advisors and for your business, and how do you really incentivize people to be involved as much as they can.
Yeah, and that's awesome. I think that's great for folks who have a startup and are like, oh, I don't have an advisor now. Like, how does all that work? That was perfect. All of the various aspects of that are perfect. So,
yeah and I think it's also a little fit, really. There's no kind of, you know, legal definition or requirement there.
Yeah, and I think part of it is, how much time are you going to spend in as an advisor, right? Some advisory roles don't take up a lot of time potentially, right? You're there maybe once in a while to advise them. Other advisory roles, like the ones I have with some of my clients, are a little more involved, right? You're spending a lot more time. You're taking on aspects of filling a role potentially that they don't want to hire a full-time role for. So I think part of it, Paul, is also the amount of time and effort in that advisory capacity will also dictate kind of how that compensation model might look.
Strongly agree. I've chatted with, you know, other industry colleagues that have, you know, taken advisory roles with different startups and everything. And sometimes, you know, the only times I've ever seen it go wrong are exactly like you said, where there's a complete mismatch in expectations, where mm-hmm. the advisor thought that they were doing something where they were going to be kind of you know, reachable for questions and things like that. And the company maybe thought that they were almost hiring them full time to do an individual contributor role. And that's the only time I've really ever seen something in this space not go well is when those expectations are just wildly mismatched.
Yeah. And now, Matt, I know some of your advisory roles, you've been pretty hands on with the marketing program, for example. Zane, in some of your cases, like what kind of roles have you played in the various companies that you're advising?
Yeah, I like, I think some of the most effective stuff that I've done, you know, you'd have to ask the companies I work with what's actually been effective, but I think the most effective stuff I've been done is being able to say, here was a very dumb thing I did, and here's how to avoid it. Yeah. And here's why it was dumb, right? Learn from my mistakes mm-hmm. along the way, because we had, in the early days of Signal Sciences, we had a lot of other founder friends that were able to guide us in a very similar fashion. And we're able to say, hey, you know, when you're going into fundraising or when you're making these mm-hmm. early executive hires or, you know, X or Y or Z, here are mistakes that we made in our companies and here's how to think about them and here's what we learned from them. And I think kind of paying it forward on that side is both, I think, the biggest value I've been able to add and the thing that I've been the most excited about is really learn from my pain, avoid the mistakes that I had to make along the way so that hopefully you can, you know, do in 2 months what took me 8 months to figure out.
Right, right.
Yeah, and I think part of it is, you know, based on your skill set as an executive, you know, you have different insights. In my particular case, right, I've done product work, I've done marketing work, I've done alliances and integration work. And so, you know, the role varies based on kind of your expertise and what you've been able to do. And I assume, Zane, that's the same for you, right? I mean, as an executive, as a founder, as a CISO, I mean, that's where your value comes in. So anybody trying to learn what to do or what not to do, that's where you have a really strong fit in your capacity, I would believe.
Oh, that's exactly it. And that's where it's been really interesting advising kind of different styles of companies, because what you can bring to the table for them varies wildly, right? For example, with the security companies that I advise, it's almost never giving advice about, you know, security or how to kind of think about their early day security program, because that's in their DNA. They get that. It tends to be much more advice about raising a seed round or raising an A or kind of equity and compensation structure or these kind of early things that if you're a first-time founder, there's not a lot out there to actually read or to really learn from, or it's stuff that's super out of date. So that would be for like the security companies. For other companies, in fact, some of the earliest companies that I ended up advising, it was really from a security expertise angle. Security was really important to them in the early days, but they were, you know, a really early company. They weren't able to make their first security hires yet. And so they wanted someone that could give solid advice that they could start on the right footing from the security perspective. And that was really where I was able to help them out.
That's great. When you look at, you know, when people come to you and they ask you to be an advisor, what kind of evaluation criteria do you use to decide whether you're going to do it or not? I assume you don't have enough time to take on every single one. Is there some criteria you use to determine, you know, which ones you are interested and not interested in?
Yeah, and it's pretty basic criteria. I would say there's no secret sauce there. I would say first and foremost, do we actually get along? Like myself and the founding team, right? It's like the running joke of life is too short to work with assholes is absolutely true. And so like, do we actually enjoy spending time with each other and enjoy kind of trading advice and having conversations on that? And then I think number two there is really, do I feel like I can be valuable? Right. I think there's plenty of times where you might look at something and say, I don't know how much value I'm actually going to add here. So why don't we not make this a formal relationship? How about we just have a few conversations off and on throughout and we can reevaluate down the line if this makes sense to become something formal. But you know, it might make sense to just we have a few conversations and that's really the kind of the maximum value I can add here. And so I'd hate for you to actually go through all of the formality there if then we're after those conversations, I'm not really going to add that much. And so I think it's really, you know, are we going to enjoy spending time together and can I really add value there? And is it something I really believe in?
Are there specific areas specifically in the security market that interest you more than others? You know, I know some of the companies you're advising because, you know, we have a lot of the same connections, right, in the industry. So I know a few of these companies.
Yeah.
And I like a couple of the companies you're advising because I think they're in really hot spaces. But do you look for a certain segment, or it doesn't matter?
I certainly don't look for a certain segment or anything like that. Like I'm not going out trying to find advisory roles or anything there. It's much more the, I actually look less kind of, I think less about the segment and much more about, do I believe in the founding team? Do I believe in the problem that they're solving? And then do we get along and can I add value? Right. Those are kind of the first two. And then it's, you know, is this security industry snake oil? Then great. Even if we got along, and we probably wouldn't get along if that was the case, but I'm not super interested. If it's usually, I mean, I'll tell you kind of the secret sauce for me is it a space where, get along with the team, you think you can add value, and it's something being built by actual practitioners, right? I think this is the things that I'm most excited about in the security industry is we're starting to see this whole new generation of security companies that are coming out of either CISOs or CTOs or security engineers, you know, anywhere up or down the ladder there that have been practitioners and said, this is a problem that we had to solve in-house because none of the vendors were solving it for us. And we're actually going to take that and turn that into a product or a service. Like that story I love so much because I think there's so much of the security industry that's just, hey, we know this is a hot new area, so we're going to put out a bunch of marketing on it and try to sell a product there that we know doesn't work. Like I think that's kind of been the history of the security industry a lot of times. And I think the biggest successes in the security industry have been those, you know, folks like Duo and folks like that, where it was practitioners who really saw a problem, they were deeply passionate about it, and they solved it spectacularly.
That's great. So let me flip this for a second. All right. So we kind of talked about your criteria for advising. I want to take it from the company perspective for a second. Why would a startup want to bring on an advisor? And how would you kind of guide a company looking for advisors? Give them some advice and recommendations, because we see a lot of startups who could leverage, you know, some of the expertise that advisors give. But how would they start? What should they expect? It would be good to get it from that angle if you could.
Yeah, I think it's, I'd really look for two things. Number one, you're either looking for someone who can give expertise in some area that you need it. That might be technical, it might be product, it might be marketing, it might be, you know, all of these different things that we talked about, or they can open doors in some way, right? And that might be fundraising or that might be customers. Those are kind of the big two. And so, hey, if you can get an advisor that can help out with both, fantastic. You hit the jackpot there. Typically, you end up seeing advisors that fill one of those two buckets. And so that's really what I think you think about from the company perspective is, does this plug a hole and kind of a gap of expertise that I can really draw on someone there that's going to help me out a lot? Or is this going to help open doors in a way to, you know, early investors or to early customers there? Or later stage as well, right? There's no reason it has to be early. It's just that you typically tend to add advisors early on rather than later on. But yeah,
and if those, I'm a company,
those buckets are really, yeah, I think the majority of them. I'm curious, have you kind of seen the same thing?
Yeah, I have. I mean, typically in my role, because I've done a number of startups in the past, similar to you, I think, you know, I have the connections with the VC community, so I can make some inroads there. I really want to help, you know, fine tune message and their go to market strategies, maybe a little product or some other things. So yes, I think those are correct, right? As you're looking for a way to open up some doors, either from a customer or a VC funding perspective, or you're looking for some very specific skill sets. And there are a few of us in the industry that can actually span both because we've been around the block long enough, but it's harder to find some of those folks sometimes. So that's, you know, it's good to give guidance to the companies.
Yeah, exactly. No, I think that's it. You really think about, you know, what are my needs as a early stage company there? And it's going to be all of the above, most likely, unless this is your third, fourth, fifth company. Mm-hmm. But if you're a first time founder, I can tell you as, you know, a first time founder, there were plenty of areas there where we wanted to be able to draw on other folks' expertise. And so that was really our focus was, could they help us in, you know, one of those buckets or the other of those buckets?
Agreed. And I think it's important for the companies to understand there is some compensation expectation sometimes when you're trying to fill those gaps, right? I mean, you could go hire somebody full time, but that's expensive as an early stage startup. So there is an expectation that advisors are going to want some sort of compensation. We talked a little bit about this, but from the company side, just realize that it may not have to be, you know, an hourly rate. It could be a little bit of equity. It incentivizes the advisors to really work on a positive outcome for the company. And so I think that's the other important thing for some of these startups to realize, is that you're not going to get a lot of free advice that's valuable longer term. If you're really looking for some of that advice and you're looking for some help in certain areas, there's going to be some compensation component typically to it.
Absolutely.
I think some startups and most startup founders, right, in any industry or vertical, are just naturally pretty stingy with equity. And it, I mean, you can't blame them, right? There's only so much equity to go around. And most founders know as they go through their journey that equity is going to be something they might have to play with for various investors and people as they, go on their journey. But I think my advice, and, you know, I've watched Shark Tank a bunch. We've been involved with so many, seen so many startups here in cybersecurity. And I don't know how you both feel, but I feel like that general advice is not to be too stingy with the equity, because if you're willing to part with some, there can be some great returns on the back end.
Yeah, I mean, I think from a compensation perspective here for advisors, look, no one's advising to get rich, right? Mm-hmm. If you're advising to try to make money, you should probably stop doing that and go get a job at McDonald's, because I think you'll, you know, probably make more money. In that way, right? You really, it's more about compensation in the sense of making sure everyone has skin in the game.
Right.
Right. And it's, you know, if folks at the end of the day, you know, if folks are compensated for their time, then they're going to be more involved. Mm-hmm. And that's basically it, right? So is there a compensation component? Absolutely. Sometimes that's equity. Sometimes that's, you know, like a mini salary, although I definitely see equity as the more standard one. Mm-hmm. But, you know, we're not talking about huge amounts here. It's much more about just making sure everybody has skin in the game, and you want to just align everybody's incentives, both in terms of taking the time and in terms of long-term incentives of growth of the company.
Now, I mean, general rule of thumb from what I've observed, and you both have observed a lot more than I have in this space, but generally advising less than 5% typically. When you get into an accelerator program, typically that's somewhere in 5 or 10%. Right? Is that general? I mean, it varies, obviously, but generally?
Yeah, from the companies I've seen go through accelerators, I think it tends to be around like 6%, 7%. Mm-hmm. I don't know a ton about that world, to be totally honest. Mm-hmm. So I think anything in the 5 to 10 range is probably numbers I've seen. But I think the most common one that I've seen is like 6 or 7. Although I've also seen accelerators that don't take equity stakes.
Sure.
Weirdly enough. So,
interesting.
Yeah, Paul, I've seen most accelerators kind of in that 7 to 10% range. 7% is kind of that rough entry layer level. So I think Zane's right, kind of 6, 7% kind of at the low end. I've seen them a little higher. Advisors, though, look, we had advisors at Layered Insight that were under 1%, right? We brought in some quality CISOs that we wanted on staff because we really wanted to understand the CISO's challenge with container security, which is what Layered Insight was doing. But we weren't giving out huge chunks of it, of equity. But they also had a more minimal role versus, you know, somebody like me coming on initially as a consultant, then taking on a chief marketing strategy role. I obviously ended up with more equity. So they vary also, Paul, just based on, again, it's how much time and commitment, what's the expectations, also varies on kind of what that equity percentage potentially looks like.
Yeah, I think as we kind of talked about in the beginning, I think it's important to bring back out here, the term advisor ends up being this huge nebulous umbrella, right? And there's ones where, exactly like you described, you start as you were a consultant, and then you came in really to kind of fulfill an executive role. That's one style advisor. Another might be someone who does a phone call once a year, right? And that's another style of advisor. Another might be one who makes, you know, one or two intros a quarter, and that's another style of advisor. Or someone who kind of, you know, lays the groundwork for a security program. All of these are totally different styles. They can all be comp different in the sense of, you know, that there's totally different, full-time individual contributor or executive roles out there that are comped totally different. And so I've seen just a huge range in compensation there as a result.
Yeah, it sounds like one of those advisory kind of roles is basically making introductions, right? It sounds to me more like a referral, right? You're advising for the company and you're going to refer them, customers, investors, and as we know in cybersecurity especially, getting talented people to come work for you, right? I think there's a lot of that as well. If you need a contractor to do a very specific thing, having an advisor is really nice because they may have someone like that in their network that they trust. And in that case, I think that's a really good example of a great advisory role helping you with basically referrals, right?
Oh yeah. I mean, this is I'd say our whole industry is one degree of separation,
yeah.
Right? It's such a small industry. And so the more that you can be connected with folks and have a strong network there, I think the better that it is to open doors, whether that's, yeah, for candidates, for customers, for investors, for other advisors, you name it. I'm very shocked when it's more than one degree of separation with anybody in the industry. That's for sure.
And I think it's also important to listen to your advisors. I think I see so many companies, right, that get maybe some of those referrals and they're like, no, we're still going to go do our own thing. Having someone that's advising, the advantage is they've been there, done that, right? And taking their advice, I think, is important. And sometimes startups, I think, just get caught up in the whole startup thing and want to go in their own direction.
It's a fine line, that's for sure.
Right. Which, I mean, it isn't always, I'm not saying it's always bad, right? But I think if you're going to enter this agreement with an advisor, you should definitely trust them enough to be able to take their advice, right? I think investors go through the same thing too. In varying levels, they try and push their various companies they've invested in certain, not directions, maybe directions technically, but more so in the referral aspect, right? Of, using various services, contractors, whatever.
It's the same for paid engagements too. Mm-hmm. I mean, if you look at some of the work that I've done for folks, sometimes they decide not to use that material.
Sure.
That's their call at the end of the day, but what you hope is you're getting value out of your advisor and that you're leveraging the expertise and the advice they're giving you and you actually take the action that they're asking you to do. I mean, that's the reason you bring them on in the first place. There are cases where they don't, and that's their prerogative. But I think in most cases, you'll see a positive outcome of learning from others that have gone through the process and hopefully not repeating those. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, that's a reason to be there in the first place, right? It's giving me flashbacks actually of pen testing, like of my pen testing days really early on of where, you'd write a report and we've all lived through this and then you'd come back a year later and it's basically the same report, like nothing's been patched or fixed. Kind of same thing of giving advice there. The reality is always somewhere in the middle, right? I think to the party giving the advice, things can seem very simple from the outside, and the party actually having to take action on the advice, it can seem really complicated and maybe too complicated. And the reality is usually somewhere in the middle.
Yeah, agreed.
I agree. Zane, any final recommendations for anybody who wants to look at advisory roles?
I don't think it's going to be any groundbreaking stuff. I think it kind of goes back to the core principles that all three of us talked about in the beginning, which is, I wouldn't jump into this just for, the sake of doing it. Really feel like you've got value to add. You've got a good relationship with whoever you're going to be advising. And really a lot of times, the first several, I think they'll tend to come to you in a lot of ways of, the more you can kind of publish stuff out there and show that you've kind of got good thoughts in the area and good kind of, I guess I'm going to use this term non-ironically for the first time ever, thought leadership in the area and can really talk about that, then, the areas that you're an expert in might be really valuable to someone who's starting a company where that's like kind of their weak area and they're very strong in other areas. So I think, don't jump into it just because it sounds cool and you want to tack that on. Like I said, I think from a comp perspective or anything like that, no one's doing it to get rich. I think the best advisors I've ever worked with on either side of the aisle there are those who are just very passionate about helping other teams and helping other founders and really trying to make the best products or companies that they can.
You know, we speak with investors, Zane, and even if you watch Shark Tank, right? The ones that get a lot of those investments, they're investing one reason because the one of the founders of the company or all of the founders are experts in that area, right? Like that's their thing. And so many investors look for that. It sounds like in advisory roles, you're looking for the same thing. Like this person is an expert in that area, sees a problem gap and is trying to solve it. And they're the expert in that area.
Yeah, I think expert, but I think also the, and this can, the two can get conflated a lot, but there's expert, but there's also passion, right? Like I like working with people who are passionate about the problems that they're solving.
Sure.
And those, you know, often if you're really passionate about an area, you kind of tend to become an expert in that area.
It's very true.
And I think bringing those two together is really important.
Paul, I'm good. Any other questions for Zane?
I'm good. This has been great. I think if you have a startup, you've got, you know, some good criteria to and understanding of how advisory relationships work. I think for those aspiring to be advisors, any advice if you're aspiring to be an advisor, Zane, are there certain things that you know you should kind of have under your belt or do to build up to that point?
Yeah, I'd say focus on the areas you're passionate on and think about how, you know, how you can really deliver value on that, right? I think, you know, off the cuff advice is very easy, but thinking about putting yourself in the shoes of people asking advice from you and thinking about the challenges that they're actually having to solve and really being able to give that much deeper advice that says, hey, I know this seems like a short-term solution to the problem, but actually here's why I'm recommending this, you know, longer term solution, or this is why I'm recommending something that seems counterintuitive at first. It's because I've seen the other advice go wrong in this way, this way, and this way, right? And really being able to think about it from their perspective. So I think passion about the space and empathy with the folks that you're advising is kind of the key.
Awesome.
Zane, thank you so much for joining us on Business Security Weekly.
Thank you so much for having me. This is a fantastic conversation. I really enjoyed it.
If anyone wants to get Zane's book, Building a Modern Security Program, please visit O'Reilly.com. Thank you for joining us, and we'll see you next week on Business Security Weekly.